Zoom hear me okay? Yeah, it's a yes. Okay, I've got the mic as close as I can. How's that? Okay. Now here's a question. We're going to record this on Zoom. Would it be better to record it here or there? Don't think it matters. Okay, Mike, you can go ahead and record, but give me a moment. So let's, if you folks at Wall Street can pass out the handouts for tonight, that would be good. And here as well, there's two, that's set, and there's one single page, and then there's, yeah, and one stapled set. I'll try and not rattle the paper near the mic. Okay, you can start the recording. And I will say good evening, everyone, here at Brightstream Temple, over there at Wall Street Zendo, and out there in the Zoom realm, wherever you may be, near and far. So tonight is the second week of our series, our Dharma Seminar series on Zen poetry through the ages. Last week we talked about the poets of the Chinese Tang Dynasty, mostly Tang Dynasty. And that poetry came to Japan along with Zen practice. So tonight we're going to look at some Japanese poets who would have known those old poets and often quoted them in their own work, if not directly, indirectly. Let's start with a poem, and this is not in your handout, so don't even look, by the beloved Japanese poet Ryokan. It goes like this. Who calls my poems poems? My poems are not poems. Only when you know my poems are not poems can we begin to speak about poems together. So those of you who were here last week may remember the poem I read by the Chinese poet Bo Jui about his ambivalence towards poetry, which he calls the demon of poetry. You may remember. Here's another one by him. He's referring to himself in the third person here. He has gradually vanquished the demon of wine and does not get wildly drunk, but the karma of words remains. He has not abandoned verse. The karma of words, well, we humans share the karma of words. They cause us no end of trouble, don't they? Really? Doesn't language get us into more trouble than anything? But you said, right? We were really hurt by words. Sometimes the most hurtful things are words. So that's why it's good for us to sit down in silence on our meditation cushions and be quiet for a while. But as human beings also, we can't do without words. We have this urge to express ourselves. And using words in this sort of compressed, imagistic, rhythmic form of poetry is one way that we touch each other's hearts and open each other's minds. Poetry goes back, has ancient roots, just as storytelling and song do, as ways that we use words to communicate our hearts to each other. And so both language and the visual arts accompanied Buddhism in that great movement from India into Chinese culture, into Japanese culture and Korean, and here in the West through these many centuries, right? As ways to express what, of course, is ultimately inexpressible. And yet, we have to give it expression. When the Japanese first came into contact with Chinese culture and language, in very early, maybe 5th century, I forgot to check, Japanese had no writing system. It was an oral language with oral poetry and song. A rich tradition of oral poetry and song and myth and legends, stories. So when Japan first encountered Chinese culture, it was highly admired. The language of civilization. And so the Japanese adopted Chinese and the Chinese writing system as the language of education and government, sort of like Latin was used in Europe. Unfortunately, perhaps, the Japanese language is both phonetically and grammatically very, very different from Chinese. The Japanese would have been better off to have encountered the alphabet we use to represent the phonetics and grammar of Japanese, but they didn't. They encountered Chinese, and resulting in the most complicated writing system in the world. So as I said, first Chinese came to be used as the language of government, religion, and literature, and all things Chinese were emulated, considered high culture. The educated Japanese nobility wrote poems in Chinese. They were called kanshi, Chinese poetry, which according to scholars who have studied these poems, they sound kind of stilted today. And they would have written them with little marks to show how to convert them into Japanese, to change the word order or to add a verb ending and to give the pronunciation. Come back to that. I just want to mention first that the poet that I just mentioned, Bo Jui, who was one of the great Chinese poets of that of the Tang Dynasty, became a kind of model for a Japanese poet named Sugawara no Michizane, who became deified as a Shinto god of poetry. And throughout Japan, there are shrines to him, to this god of poetry, at which Japanese students now make prayers to pass, you know, for university exams or high school exam, the exams they take to get into university. Those are the really crucial ones. So it's a kind of curious evolution. So early Japanese song or poetry had its origins in seasonal agricultural rituals, as many traditional indigenous societies in the case of. And they had a kind of breath rhythm or rhythm of syllables that as poems came, began to be written down, these rhythms became codified into two forms, waka, which is short form, which goes five syllables, seven, five, seven, seven, or a choka, which is a long poem, five, seven, five, seven, five, seven, seven, seven. And these began to be written down first using Chinese characters given a Japanese pronunciation. So they were used for their phonetic value rather than, so Chinese characters are ideographs, right? It means they represent an idea or a thing. So a tree looks like a tree, a mountain looks like a mountain. But these began to be used phonetically in Japan, and then they were simplified to a more of a cursive shape, just like simplified, which I could show you. So it became a kind of what's called a syllabary, a syllabic script, so that each character represents a syllable rather. So it goes, they go, here they are, a, I, u, a, o, ka, ki, ku, ke, ko, sa, shi, su, se, so, ta, chi, tsu, te, to, etc. Each is a syllable. And these simplified versions, which are called hiragana, became known as women's writing. These women weren't educated, for the most part, didn't get education in Chinese, but they did learn to write in hiragana, and began to write beautiful, naturally expressed colloquial poems and diaries and what's reputed to be the first novel in the world, The Tale of Genji by Lady Murasaki. So there's this old tradition of women writing poetry and being famed, very well regarded. So during that same period, and we're talking 10th century, 9th, 10th, Buddhist monks developed a parallel phonetic script that was sort of more angular, and it's called katakana, which that was used to give the Japanese pronunciation to sutras, or like the Heart Sutra that we all chant to this day, or poetry. And later, katakana came to be used in modern times to be used for any word that comes from a foreign language. So, for example, pan came from the Portuguese, from early Portuguese traders, and it came from bread, the word for bread. And so bread in Japan to this day is called pan. And hambaga is what you get when you go to Makodonarudo. And it's pretty much the favorite food of most 10-year-old Japanese children these days. And you can tell because they're much bigger than their grandparents, much taller, or their great-grandparents. And then pasokon. Pasokon is an abbreviation for Pasonaru Computa, personal computer. But when it's abbreviated, it becomes unrecognizable as an English word. So they're called loan words from foreign languages into Japanese are quite fascinating and have found their way into contemporary poetry, but we're not going there today. So all this background, which please excuse me if you're not a kind of translation nerd like I am, this is This is just to explain how, by the time Zen reached Japan, it was already a well-established practice for Buddhist monks to be educated to read and write in Chinese. So Dogen would have learned, Dogen, who was the Japanese monk who went to China and brought our tradition, our Soto Zen tradition, back to Japan, or those who first went, the Rinzai, first early Rinzai monks, would have already learned Chinese before they even went, and then learned more once there. And so we find them writing both kanshi, these poems in Chinese, and also waka, written in ordinary Japanese, and later haiku, which we'll spend some time with next week, that most condensed of Japanese poetic forms that has spread all over the world. The people writing haiku in many, many, many languages these days. It's hard for translators to convey the difference in flavor between a poem that was written in Chinese and a poem that was written in Japanese, but the Chinese ones are more formal, and they're often quite dense with references to Chinese poets and quotes and Zen lore, whereas waka have a kind of more free-flowing, natural feeling with many images from nature. Dogen, as I said, wrote both kanji and waka. And even Dogen expressed this ambivalence towards using words to express the inexpressible. There's one that's not in your handout that I'm going to read that echoes the words of Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma, the Indian monk who brought Zen to China, who said something like, paraphrasing a bit, that Zen is a special transmission outside the teaching, so not from the sutras, not directly from the texts or the sutras, special transmission outside the teaching, not dependent on words and letters. So Zen being a practice of direct experience, embodied experience. So, which has led many people to think, throw all the books out. Don't read books about Zen. Don't write. But Dogen took a rather different approach. Even though he expressed ambivalence, he also recognized that words can be used to express, as close as we can, the inexpressible. And also words can be used to subvert words. And he did that a lot. Kind of makes your head spin sometimes. So here's the one poem where he says, "The Dharma, like an oyster washed up on a high cliff, even waves crashing against the rocky coast, like words, may reach it but not wash it away." He seems to be struggling a little bit with his metaphor here. It's a little hard for me to imagine an oyster washed up on a high cliff and the waves as the Dharma, but that's okay. His point is, we can't quite reach it, but we can't wash it away with our words. And then he follows that. That's with the title. He titles that "A Special Transmission Outside the Teaching." Then he follows with another one. The title is "No, Not Relying on Words or Letters." And that is in your handout. So you may now pick up your handout. The first page of the one that's stapled is the Dogen poems. These are waka. In fact, you can see the Japanese on the left-hand side. And number 16J is the one that he titled "No Reliance on Words or Letters," Furyu Monji. I suteshi sono koto no hano hoka nareba fude ni mo, fude ni mo ato tadoan zarikeri. Not limited by language, it is ceaselessly expressed. So too, the way of letters can display but not exhaust it. So again, he's talking about the Dharma not limited by language, and yet we ceaselessly express it, not displaying it, but not exhausting it. So that kind of paradox of language. So I'd like to pause, John, just for a moment. And I'd like you all to just take a few minutes to read through. There's two pages of Dogen poems here, maybe just the first page. On the flip side, there are some more. I'll give you a few minutes. I'd like you, if you're able, I don't know how many of you at home have accessed this handout. I will screen share it for you, but you won't be able to mark. If you have it at home, if you printed it out, you could. What I'd like you to do is get a pen. I don't know if we can collect some pens here. And in Wall Street, you've got pens and paper. And I'd like you to just go through, read these Dogen poems to yourselves, and just mark any line or image that resonates, that stands out for you in some way. Okay? Let's just take just a few minutes to do that. So we'll pause the recording and we'll come back, okay?